Today on the 21st, when dogs risk death in the line of duty.
A poppy seed size amount of the powder can kill a dog. And police canine dogs are going into some of these facilities to sniff out if there are drugs, getting that tiny amount and collapsing.
We wrap up our week-long series on the opioid crisis in Illinois by learning about efforts to save canine officers exposed to life-threatening drugs in the line of duty. Also, when it comes to the universe and questions about it, the vast majority of them have the same answer: we have no idea.
To me, the most exciting things about science are the things that are still left to be discovered. And so talking about all the unanswered questions is more inspirational sometimes than explaining the things we already know.
But first, best-selling author Steve Hamilton joins me to talk about his latest Chicago crime novel. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Nick Mason's Chicago is everything a gritty crime fiction writer would imagine, with a heavy dose of reality thrown in. It's a world created by award-winning and best-selling author Steve Hamilton. The second of his series of books about Nick Mason just came out this week. It's called Exit Strategy. Hamilton, a Michigan native, joins me now here in downtown Chicago. Hey, Steve, welcome to the 21st.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
So you are a prolific writer. Is this your 12th? The beginning of the series was your 12th
Yeah, this is
book?
13, I
this
think.
This is 13. Now, your first series set in Michigan, right, where you're from originally. Why did you choose Chicago for the Nick Mason series?
When I was thinking up this character, one of the first things that you decide is where he's from, because where you come from is such a big part of who you are. And there's something about Chicago, and specifically the South Side, that just felt like this is where this guy has to come from. And I felt like, growing up right around the lake, that I knew the city just well enough to write about it. Although when I came here to really live here for, you know, for a while and to really get to know it, I think I really discovered that this amazing city is unlike anything I ever expected.
Yeah, I think so. And we can talk about that in a minute, but I want to talk about Nick Mason for a little bit, your character. So in my head, I kind of decided he was like Vin Diesel, you know, because I was trying to think of a guy who's really big, but still has kind of a face that children love, like that children are not scared of. And
right.
I wonder, sort of in your head,
I don't think he's that big, really.
Okay.
I mean, he's just a tough guy. I mean, he grew up in on the South Side, and he became a criminal, and he was stealing cars, and you know, all the while he kept some very strict codes for himself and some very strict rules to sort of keep himself alive and stay out of prison. He was a very good criminal.
And those rules we learn about in the first book, and it was fascinating to me, sort of, he's in prison. So
right.
When we first meet Nick, he's actually just leaving prison.
Right, he's walking out.
Right. But he has this code that he creates, these rules for himself to survive being in prison.
Right.
I imagine that's probably, did you talk to people? It seems like something that would make sense for someone to try to figure out, this is how I'm going to survive being
right.
incarcerated.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent time in maximum security prisons, which is, again, part of being a crime writer is that research and going to the places where your characters are going to be. And it was an amazing experience, by the way. If you ever have a chance to go to a maximum security prison, I hope it's not for long, but if you ever go there and just visit for an hour, even though you know you're getting out in an hour, there's something that happens when that door closes. It's just like this physical reaction to it. And that was the feeling that I used as a writer when I was trying to imagine what Nick Mason would have felt like if he went to this place and the door closed, and he knew he was probably never going to come out. And that mindset is what, you know, is sort of where you first see him when he's taken this deal from Darius Cole that gets him out because he has to go back and see his family again. And so that's, you know, even though he is a criminal, I hope you can relate to that motivation that he has just to see his daughter again.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that ambiguity, right? Because he's a character who kills people for a living, and as we sort of see his transition into the second, you kind of start to see how he actually gets really good at killing people, right? But he's also, before we get to that, a character that I think is a very likable character, And I think that you are cheering for him, right? You kind of, you feel like he's in a really tough situation. And you, at least for me, I was feeling like, okay, I'm on this guy's side.
That's the challenge of writing a character like this. And that's been the most amazing thing about the response to the series. Because, you know, as a writer, you're never sure that you can pull that off.
But that was your intention with
that. That was my intention. That was my hope. But it's people have really responded to this character. And I think it's that side of him that they get to see, especially like in the first book, when he finally sees his daughter again after all this time, going through all these brutal things. You understand that he's doing all this just to have that moment where he can tell his daughter, who he hasn't seen in 5 years, that he just made a mistake and he just wants to be her father.
But when you thought about that, and then you sort of think about his boss, who was a much more unambiguous character, right. When you kind of, I wonder if I could get inside your head a little bit as you're developing these characters, do you decide from the beginning that this is going to be, that we're not, or we've yet to see with his boss, this kind of crime lord, Darius Cole, we don't really see a good side to him.
You really don't, but in the second book, at least you start to understand him and where he came from. Hemingway once said that a writer should understand his characters but not judge them. And that's really what I try to do. It's just, I just want you to understand, especially for somebody like Darius Cole, who obviously doesn't have anything on paper that you could root for. At least just understand where he came from and what choices he had growing up, and what drives him, and how that's really not that much different maybe than you and I. He just obviously has a whole different way of going about it. But I just try to understand him, and then you as a reader can judge what kind of person he ultimately is.
Right, and so then the other kind of character in this is Chicago, right? Because
right, yeah.
This is such a, Chicago is such a city of neighborhoods.
It is.
And you do are very specific about where Nick comes from, where Darius comes from. Right. How did you pick those neighborhoods?
Just spending time here, really. When I decided this is where he's from, I just came here and I got to know a lot of the people who live here and spent time with the police officers. I have a good friend who's a homicide detective, which these days is a pretty tough job. For this second book especially, I got to know an assistant U.S. attorney who works in that office and really learn about that job. I didn't realize just how important these guys are to every federal case. It has to basically start with the U.S. attorney's office. You can't even charge somebody without calling them and asking permission. It's all part of the process of living in this world, and that was the nicest thing about it, was just getting to know Chicago a lot better. It's a beautiful, amazing city.
What kind of research, so how much time did you spend with people like your friend you said who's a homicide right. detective, the assistant U.S. attorney? How much research do you
it's
put into
been,
before you start
it's
writing?
It's been 2 or 3 years now of just, not all the time, but coming back here a lot and just hanging out and driving around. And you know, I'll just go into a bar sometimes, and you can tell who wants to talk in a bar, you know. And I'll just start talking about something.
Do you tell them what you do, or you just start talking?
No,
okay, you don't.
No, I don't. Eventually, maybe it'll come out.
All right.
But I love that kind of research where you just go into a bar, the local bar, and you can tell these people have lived there.
It's their bar.
It's their bar. And
yeah.
I'm very conscious of that, and I don't try to be the big shot. You know, I think that would ruin it if I tried. Hey, I'm a big time, big shot New York Times.
You don't say I've won an Edgar Award.
No. I just hang out and I just, hey, what's it like living here? You know, well, you know, I bet you've been here your whole life, and people like to talk about things that they care about, which is why cops like to talk about their job, and somebody who lives in a neighborhood likes to talk about what it is that makes that. To them makes this place special. And that's all I do. I'm a very good listener.
And so it's interesting because all of that listening does lead to Chicago, the way that Chicago is depicted. And I do think, and I think you know this as well, you, like myself, both people who are not from Chicago, I think the first thing you learn when you come to Chicago, if you're not from Chicago, is to never say that you're from this town, right? Because people are so proud of being from Chicago. It's kind of a joke how fast they say, I'm from Chicago. And so you can always say, well, this isn't where I'm from. You could live here for 30 years and say, I know I'm really not from here. I've just lived here for 30 years. Were you intimidated by that, by picking Chicago?
I was aware of it, I would say. I wasn't really intimidated by it because I think I've done that before in other places. I think if you're just true to the place and you're just really honest and you respect the place, I think people see that. I think it comes through in the writing, too. I think it comes through that I really do love this place and that I'm not trying to make fun of it or just take an easy pot shot at the crime problems or any of the more obvious things that are in the papers. I just try to understand it.
Right. And I should point out, as Chicago Tribune actually pointed out for in the review of your first book, that you were an outsider who did a pretty good job of capturing.
That felt really good. That was a front page review in the in that section of the paper, and it was a great review of the first book. And when I read that part about how it's not often that an outsider gets Chicago right, then that was like the best thing that I ever could have read.
I'm speaking with Steve Hamilton. We're talking about his latest Nick Mason novel. It's called Exit Strategy. It just came out this week. And in the second book, you know, we talked about Nick. He's really trying to find his way out of this life, right? And I'm not going to give anything away. There's some great twists and turns that happen here. But in your head, where is Nick at the beginning of this book? What do you think his mindset is?
Well, at the beginning of this book, sort of at the end of the first book, the first book was all about him getting out of prison and discovering what the price was that he'd have to pay to, you know, when he made this deal. And if you think about it, I mean, every time that phone rings, it's just, and that's a terrible sort of vice grip that you have to live in, always being watched. Knowing that everybody that you come in contact with, you could be putting them in danger.
Right. So the guy who gets him out of prison, he's now beholden to.
Exactly. So as this book begins, like you said, it begins with a bang. He's on his next mission, and these missions are just getting more and more dangerous and brutal. And he's finding it harder and harder to hold on to that one thing that one piece of his code, which is to not kill anybody that's not a target. He's going to such lengths, and it's getting harder and harder. And he just inside, he can feel himself turning into this machine, and he's losing his humanity. And he decides, I have to get out of this, no matter what I have to do.
There are there's like sort of this melding, and I wonder, as you do, you were saying you talk to, well, you have a good friend who's a homicide detective. One thing that I thought I was thinking a lot about when I was reading this is there's a lot of good police officers. There's a lot of bad police officers in here. And I wonder if you thought about especially now, kind of as we're in sort of this national moment of having a conversation about policing. Is that something you thought about when you were writing this?
Well, I was just going back, you know. It is something that we're all very aware of here, but Chicago has its own history, good and bad. There really was a crew of cops called the SOS that operated in the city a number of years ago, long before any of these other things started happening, and they did kind of rule this town for a few years, and there was a very high profile case.
Yeah, I have to say, kind of, I was wincing every time you said Holman Square in the book because I kept thinking about John Birch,
right?
And for those who are not aware, sort of the infamous torture of multiple people that went on under his command. The only reparations lawsuit that's ever existed, that's ever happened in the country here in Chicago, just settled 2 years ago, I think it was at this point, right?
Right.
And so every time you mention Holman Square in the book, I kind of winced inside.
I what you mean, but it's funny, when I was writing that first book, that was before all that stuff even
had come out, before it had all come out.
But that's where the SOS crew was located. So that's really, that was the only way that I had, the only connection that I had to that place. And I was just really sort of blown away when that stuff did come out. It's like, it was almost like it was worse than I could have imagined as a crime writer.
It was the reality
right.
of it. But then on the other hand, so there's those really tough ones. And then there's also an incident you have, which I have to say, it just sort of started laughing when I was reading it, because this is also true. In 2012, the guys who escaped from from the downtown Metropolitan right? Correction Center. Literally, I will never forget the TV footage. They had the sheets. Sheets, and they just threw them over, and they went out.
Just like in an old movie, they actually did that. You're right.
So, how much real life stuff does kind of ends up in here? Are you someone who reads the crime section, or are you always kind of following that news?
I really am, especially now in this town. Now that I have a series based here, I'm all the stuff every day. I have a feed that comes in, and I see all the stuff that's going on here.
And that said, then I guess I wonder how much then you do that is. Where do you sort of draw the line between thinking about what ends up in this series than in Nick Mason's world versus real life?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be respectful of the fact that, I mean, this is a real place and these are real problems and people are definitely impacted by them. I do have a cop in this book who goes to Homewood Square and sort of reflects on the fact that that it's getting hard for him to do his job. And this goes back to the idea, I mean, you've got a few bad cops, every city does. And they reflect badly on everybody else. But a friend like my friend John, who just gets up and wants to just do a good job for this city every day, sometimes they're the ones who pay for it because it makes their job a lot harder. And I just try to be – I don't try to get too hung up on that or really dwell on it too much because it really shouldn't be about that.
Steve's going to be back in town in June for Printers Row Lit Fest, so you can catch him then. Next month, June 10th through 11th. Right now, I want to thank him. So the latest book, it's called Exit Strategy. Great summer reading. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The introduction to a new book on astrophysics says it all. Would you like to know how the universe began, what it's made of, and how it will end, to understand where time and space come from, to know whether we are alone in the universe? Too bad, this book will not give you any of those answers. The title of this book is appropriately, We Have No Idea. It's full of comic illustrations. That's because one of the authors is Jorge Cham, the creator of the popular online comic Piled Higher and Deeper, or PhD Comics. He earned his PhD in robotics at Stanford. The other co-author, Daniel Whiteson, is a professor of experimental particle physics at the University of California, Irvine. Both of them will be in Illinois, in Batavia, at Fermilab tonight at 8 o'clock to speak about their new book. We're going to tweet out all of that information, have it available at our website at 21stshow.org. Jorge and Daniel are on the line with me now. Hey, guys, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So many books are written to explain what we know about a subject. Why did you all decide to take a different approach? Which one of you guys wants to answer that?
I feel like our ignorance in science represents opportunity. It's something that's exciting. You know, once you answer a mystery, it sometimes loses some of its appeal. And to me, the most exciting things about science are the things that are still left to be discovered. And so talking about all the unanswered questions is more inspirational sometimes than talking about and then explaining the things we already know.
Yeah, Jorge, do you agree?
Yeah, you know, I think we both had the general feeling that, you know, the public and people in general kind of have the sense that, you know, scientists have everything figured out, that, you know, those people in lab coats have the world figured out and we are at the peak of human knowledge. But yeah, I think we both felt that it's really surprising how much that's not true, how much there is still to know, how much there is still to discover in the universe.
And would you guys say, is this sort of a maybe, I wonder, is this an unpopular opinion in the scientific community to highlight what you don't know? Do you think, Daniel, I don't know, do you think that kind of goes against the philosophy or the culture of science?
No, not at all. I think science is all about exploring the unknown. And I think that everybody in the science community would agree that these questions are unanswered and that they're important, and we'd like to answer them. I think that sometimes the really big questions, the really deep questions, you know, like what is time, what is space, are so big that they're difficult to approach. And so often in the scientific community, we focus on smaller, manageable chunks that we can tackle. But I thought it was useful to take a step back and look at the larger landscape. But I don't think people in science would disagree that, or think that it's an unfair characterization.
Yeah, and I think there are all of these really big questions about time and space and the universe. We've been talking about dimensions. One of the producers and I have been looking at dimensions all morning and trying to understand them. But I wanted to ask you, Jorge, I like the illustration sort of approach to this. It makes a lot of sense. There are certain times when I was when you're looking through this, and some of the concepts obviously are pretty dense and difficult and could go over your head, but the illustrations, and I'm thinking particularly of like this is the structure of the universe comic, that helps really crystallize and makes it a lot easier to understand. So Jorge, when did you first start thinking that all of this stuff might be easier explained via pictures or comics as opposed to just words?
So kind of the history of it is that, you know, I draw these comics online about grad students and researchers, but while I was doing that, I would sometimes explain the research that the scientists and the researchers did, just because I sort of found it fascinating. And then Daniel, you sort of saw some of the comics that I made, and he's the one who sort of made the connection, oh, we should use comics to try to explain physics.
Yeah, how did you guys meet? How did you guys decide to collaborate on this book?
The book project came after we made some videos together. And as Jorge said, I was thinking that cartoons and comics would be a great way to explain physics because a lot of the topics in physics are a bit abstract, but they can be nicely summarized in little cartoons. Like a tool that we use all the time in physics for real are Feynman diagrams, which are these little squiggles that describe how particles interact and how they bounce off each other. In reality, they're like little physics cartoons. And so I thought it would be a great way to describe what we're doing, but I don't have any artistic skills myself. So I thought to talk to somebody who had both artistic skills, which Jorge obviously does, and a scientific background to really understand what we're trying to convey. So that's how it began, and we made a few videos online about dark matter and then the Higgs boson and gravitational waves, and then we started thinking about the book project to sort of expand on this idea of explaining these things with both words and comics together.
And how did that process work, Jorge? Did you decide you were going to do, for example, we're going to talk about the structure of the universe, and then do you think about drawing that, or were there topics that you had already maybe done some illustrations for? How did you decide what to illustrate and what not to?
Sure. So our process usually started, we picked the list of things to talk about in the book, and then the process would usually start with Daniel, who would sort of write a first draft, and then we would sort of kind of go back and forth on the written part. And so once, it wasn't until really the written part was sort of locked, and we were both sort of happy with that read well and that explained things well, that's kind of when I went into the cartoonist mode, which is what I would sort of read it and think about where cartoons might explain things even better, or when they might kind of add a nice break or humor note to the narrative.
Yeah, why are you guys obsessed with eyeballs? There's a lot of eyeballs in this book.
Well, you got to have eyeballs to get eyeballs. So,
And there's also a lot of puns. I don't know who, Daniel, if that's you who writes the puns versus the everything else that happens in the book. But let's talk about some of the big topics that you guys tackle. And why don't we just start with the biggest one, which is the universe. And I wanted to ask you about, you all write about this, about, you know, obviously there was a point in time when the scientific consensus was that the universe has always existed in its current state. And then when the Big Bang Theory came along, that was ridiculed before it became accepted. And I think that we know this about the scientific process. Are there things that we assume today about the universes that you think we might be totally wrong about?
Absolutely. And that is the exciting thing, is that when we look back in history, we see that the things people assumed were true turned out to be totally untrue. That from our particular perspective as tiny little humans on this rock, we make assumptions about the way the universe works, and then nature reveals to us through the scientific method that we were wrong. And it's almost impossible to imagine now what it is that we think is definitely true about the universe, which could turn out to be totally wrong. And that is the excitement of these unanswered questions, right? It's the possible magnitude of the discoveries is staggering. You know, we could discover something which completely changes our view of the human situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jorge, is that something you think about a lot? I mean, as you're thinking there, these are really big questions.
Yeah, you know, it's not something that you sort of think about every day.
Right, that would probably be a big burden.
I was just really blown away. I mean, I think I kind of went into this as a reader of the book, which is, you know, I was just really blown away by all the things that you would think that humanity would have answered by now, but really, we really don't have any idea. And so, yeah, just that was really mind-blowing for me and fascinating to talk to Daniel about these things. And so I really had this urge that more people needed to know about this because it's so amazing.
Yeah. And Daniel, I mean, I guess my question I had for you is, why is it you think that much of the universe isn't really observable to us?
Well, we don't know how much of the universe is observable. I mean, we've seen a huge swath of the universe, but we don't know if that's a tiny fraction or if that's most of it. And the reason is just that we can't see further than this sphere, which is surrounding us, which is how far light has traveled since the beginning of the universe. And anything beyond that, we just can't see. So we don't know if there's anything or nothing or everything or crazy dancing purple dragons. We really just can't see beyond that because there's this maximum speed limit of information, and the universe isn't old enough for us to see beyond that.
Yeah, well, and I know that, I mean, you guys write about this, right, that the expansion of the universe has been taking place for 14 billion years and counting. So do you think that, is it true that there's, if the universe is expanding at a faster and faster rate, could there come a point in time where we could look up in the sky and we wouldn't see stars because they're so far away?
That's absolutely possible. The universe is expanding at a faster, faster rate, as you say, and it's pulling galaxies away from each other. Eventually, it can pull galaxies apart. And so it's certainly possible that far into the future, people or whoever lives on Earth could look up in the sky and see it be totally black. And they could never know the difference. They could never know what the sky used to look like in the early history of the universe. And then you have to play a mental game with yourself. Well, we're 14 billion years in already. What would the sky have looked like if we had lived 10 billion years ago? What information about the universe are we not learning because we came along pretty late in the universe?
Well, and I think all of this gets to sort of the timing of all of this is really interesting, right? Because I think that maybe I read too much science fiction, but I think that all of these things always lead to the big question that lots of people like to ask when you're talking about these things, which is are we alone in the universe, right? And so I want to ask both of you guys about that because you have a whole chapter of the book that gets to that. And Jorge, can I ask you, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that there's life out there?
I think the fascinating part about that is that there is an answer. You know, as we point out in the book, you know, whether there is life elsewhere in the universe or not is a fact. We just don't know. We just haven't been able to confirm it. We just don't know whether it's true or not. As Mulder from The X-Files said, the answer is out there. We just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Daniel, how would you answer that?
I think what Jorge says is spot on, and I think that the fascinating thing about all the questions in the book is that there are hard and fast answers that we can discover. In my case, I would be shocked if there wasn't life out there in the universe, given the number of stars and the number of Earth-like planets. On the other hand, we just really don't know. I mean, the probability of creating life, given the right conditions, could be one in a quadrillion. We just have one example.
Right, right. So when you talk about the big questions and then the questions that maybe we do know, I wanted to ask you something that's maybe a little more answerable than the big questions about life in the universe out there. I wanted to go a little smaller and talk about particles and atoms. And I wanted to ask you all a question. Some of us may have heard that despite all the particles and atoms that make up who we are, we're mostly empty space. And you guys say that's partially true. How would you answer that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by empty space, unfortunately. So it's sort of a technical answer. And if you think about what makes up the atom, you know, it has a hard core of a nucleus, which is protons and neutrons, the electrons whizzing around it. And so there certainly is empty space between the neutron and the electron, and that's really the nucleus and the electrons, that's what gives the atom its size. But what gives you your size is also the fact that these atoms tie themselves together and push themselves apart. You can think of yourself not like empty space, but more like a chain link fence of these things knotted together to make a coherent whole. The way you might like weave fabric out of strings, right, doesn't mean that you're mostly string. You know, you weave it together to make something else.
Yeah. So when you guys were working on the book, I wonder, as you were working on this, what you decided to put in and what you decided to not put in to ideas. And when you're thinking about, you know, particles and atoms versus the big questions, Daniel, how did you sort of whittle down this list?
That's a great question. We really wanted to focus on things that everybody could understand the question, right? That people would, without having a PhD in physics, you understood why the question was important, right? Like, what is the universe made out of? How will the universe end? These questions that everybody just wants to know the answer to because they touch a nerve of basic human curiosity. And questions that could be answered, questions that have answers, that are scientific questions. And so those were our requirements when we were thinking about what questions we wanted to talk about. And there are a bunch of other questions that satisfy that, but we didn't quite feel like fit in with the nature of the book, and other questions that are really interesting and fascinating but aren't really answerable or might not be scientific.
So there's a sequel in the works maybe of other things that you guys wanted to get to?
There's certainly a lot more things that we don't know.
Right.
Our next book might be called We Have Some Ideas.
That would be good.
We still have no idea.
Or we still have no idea. Right. Well, and Jorge, for you, do you still work in robotics?
No, I've been cartooning for full-time for a while now, maybe over 10 years.
Okay. And so I wonder how all of these discussions or the topics that you guys picked for this book made you think differently about the universe.
The experience of reading the book and especially writing the book, it really kind of wakes you up a little bit. And it really kind of affects how you look at the world after reading the book. You know, after thinking about, because the book kind of goes from very little things to basically the biggest things possible. And so it's really hard after reading the book not to sort of look at things a little bit differently and kind of wonder what it's all about. You know, these atoms, these things that we think are in ourselves that we think are pretty solid and very, very real, they're actually sort of very kind of ephemeral. You know, they're little quantum, wavy energy objects. And so you sort of start to see the world a little bit differently, you know, kind of like what Daniel said about the chain link fence. You know, we're all sort of these kind of clumps of wavy energy, strange quantum objects, and bouncing around this universe that is just full of things that we really don't understand.
Yeah, Daniel, and I think a lot of this gets into, and you guys talk about this at the end of the book, right? That there's sort of the bounds between science and philosophy. You know, and I wonder, do you think sometimes it does veer more into these philosophical questions, or is that just kind of maybe the end result of a lot of scientific inquiry of big questions is to turn to philosophy? Says a former philosophy major, I should tell you guys, I was a philosophy major.
Uh-oh.
There are a lot of philosophy majors in public radio.
I think science and philosophy have a very natural relationship, and a lot of scientific answers need philosophy in order to interpret them. You can have a hard fact, but then you ask the question, what does that mean for us? How does it change how we live our lives? What do I believe about that? There's lots of philosophical implications to scientific discoveries. I think it's just important sometimes to draw the line and ask, is this a philosophical idea or is this a scientific idea? And as we say in the book, a lot of things started out as philosophy because they weren't really testable, and then moved into the scientific realm because people came up with new tools. I think that's pretty cool.
That's Daniel Whiteson. He's a professor of experimental particle physics at the University of California, Irvine. I want to thank Jorge Cham as well, creator of the online comics Piled Higher and Deeper, or PhD Comics. They're both going to be, you can catch them this evening if you would like to hear more about this, at Fermilab in Batavia. We'll tweet out all of those details. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All week we've been talking about Illinois' opioid crisis. The number of people dying from drug overdose in Illinois is on the rise. All the while, drug addiction treatment providers have been struggling as their funding from the state has been cut in half over the past decade. The situation has only been made worse by the almost two-year-long budget impasse. Yesterday, we heard from public officials in Illinois about what they're doing to help people in communities that have been affected by the opioid epidemic all across the state. All of these conversations, by the way, are all at our website, 21stshow.org. During the week, we've also taken a look at what addiction looks like, and we've talked to different providers who've been particularly affected by the budget crisis. Today, we wanted to conclude our week-long series with a discussion about how the opioid crisis is affecting one particular aspect of law enforcement that might surprise you. The DEA announced last year that canine officers, dogs that accompany police on drug raids, are facing an unprecedented threat: death from exposure to drugs that are 100 to 10,000 times more powerful than heroin. In Champaign, Illinois Vet Med is working with local, state, and national agencies to develop protocols that could help save working dogs that are exposed. To learn more about this, I'm joined now by Dr. Maureen McMichael, a professor in veterinary clinical medicine at the University of Illinois. I'm also joined by two physicians from Carl Regional Emergency Medical System, Dr. Michael Smith and Dr. Brad Weir. Doctors McMichael, Smith, Weir, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. McMichael, let's start with you. There are illegally manufactured drugs out there that are 100 to 10,000 times even more powerful than heroin. What kind of drugs are we talking about?
So there's a drug called fentanyl, and fentanyl is being added to heroin. And fentanyl is much more potent. It's 50 times as potent as heroin. It's 100 times as potent as something called morphine, which is a common drug. And then there's an even more potent drug that veterinarians use to tranquilize elephants, and it's called carfentanil. And carfentanil is 10,000 times as potent as morphine.
And these are things people are using as illegal drugs on the streets?
Yes. And people are dying, too, because obviously they're so potent. And so what's happening is a tiny, truly a poppy seed size amount of the powder can kill a dog. And dog search and rescue dogs, police canine dogs, are going into some of these facilities to sniff out if there are drugs, getting that tiny amount and collapsing.
And so that's what makes them more vulnerable than, say, police officers, because maybe I imagine the police officers are wearing protective gear. The dogs, I guess their whole point is that they're not wearing protective gear because they need to be smelling and sniffing these things out.
That's correct.
So how does it work? How does a police officer know that a dog has been exposed to one of these extremely powerful drugs?
This is really one of the many areas that the dog is just like a human. Any human or dog that's overdosed is first going to get sleepy. Second off, get confused, weak, wobbly, eventually go to sleep. If it's a severe enough overdose, it starts to depress respiration, and then to the point of coma and ultimately death.
And Dr. Smith, how fast does this happen?
This can happen with a really potent overdose in as little as 30 seconds. This is clearly the number one public health crisis we're facing in the United States today. Over 40,000 deaths from these drugs just last year.
From people, obviously, yes, we're talking people. About, right?
Yeah.
And we've, of course, had lots of conversations on the 21st about this regarding people. And we will tweet out some of those links if you follow 21ST Show. I guess it's an interesting to think about this in terms of canines. When did this first come up and start appearing as a problem? Dr. McMichael, when did we start noticing this with canine police officers?
We were contacted by the Springfield Police, and they asked us if we would give them some training on Narcan, which is a trade name of naloxone, which is a reversal for this drug. And they contacted us because they said that there are several dogs in their area that have gone down from this.
And the dogs that have died then.
And some dogs have died. Three dogs in Florida collapsed but were treated in time. And then in Springfield, several dogs have gone down and a couple have died. We don't have, one of the problems is no one's keeping track. There is no national database to keep track of what is happening with these dogs. So we don't really have good numbers.
Dr. Ware, Dr. McMichael mentioned Narcan, naloxone. That's something that is used with people. First of all, can you just explain what that is and how it works?
So it's an antidote for opioid overdose and essentially helps to unbind the opioid, whatever that may be, like heroin or fentanyl, carfentanil, et cetera. Helps to unbind that from the receptors that cause people to become drowsy and then potentially lose their respirations and go into coma and so forth.
And that's something that's, you know, been somewhat controversial at times, but is now approved for, do police officers, like who's carrying Narcan now? Is that in ambulances? What are
the
laws about it?
It's been in ambulances for decades, and then it's been used in human hospitals, you know, for decades also. Starting in on July 1st of 2015, we started a program through Carl EMS and Champaign County Sheriff's Office to have them carry that. And then subsequent to the Heroin Crisis Act passing, then that's you know, been expanded to other police agencies throughout the state, as well as other fire departments.
And so are police trained to administer this to people?
Yes.
And what's involved with how that's administered?
Most often it's given through an intranasal route. So there's a pre-filled syringe that's essentially just screwed together. Comes in two separate pieces. It's put together. And then a mist atomizer device, which is basically just a attachment that helps to aerosolize this or make it into a fine mist so it can cover the surface of the nose. That can be attached, and then it basically half the amount sprayed into each nostril. So it's a fairly simple administration.
Dr. Smith, you're medical director for Carl Regional Emergency Medical System and Aero Ambulance. It seems like then it's logical that this could just be administered to dogs, but is that not the case? Is it more complicated than that?
That's the great thing about this, is that it's not more complicated. This is an area where the dog physiology and human physiology is identical. And literally for the police breeds, they're of such a size that we can give the full adult dose to the dog and expect the same effect in the dog that we would expect in a human. The thing that is important is that there are entirely too many officers out there who are not aware of that fact. And we have reports even of police dogs dying from overdoses on narcotics when the officer was carrying Narcan on their person and didn't know it was okay to give it to the dog. And so that really is the thesis of the core behind our effort in integrating with the vet med, is to get this message out to our officers and make them better prepared to help their animal.
Dr. McMichael, is this something, are there also any legal issues or are there oversight issues with different police officers or medical systems or ER? Or I imagine emergency departments probably aren't equipped to treat animals, right? Let me just ask you, Dr. McMichael, before we get to you, Dr. Smith, if someone bought a police dog into any ER, could they be treated? You guys are already shaking your heads.
We would not register them as a patient. What we would do is try to render, you know, aid just as any other citizen would. We would start making a lot of phone calls and get that animal to the appropriate resources. We're blessed in Champaign County to have one of the leading teaching hospitals in vet med in the United States right here. And so we know who we'd be calling to get that animal the correct care. In a very rural area, it might be a situation where you're simply calling individual veterinarians to see who can come in and help out.
I see. Dr. McMichael, so is that a case where if this has happened in Champaign County, are you all contacted? Does Illinois Vet Med get contacted to help in these situations?
Yes. And that's part of, we've created a task force to come up with a transport protocol so that if an ambulance does pick up one of these police dogs, they know exactly where to go. They know the phone number. They know that we've already been contacted in advance, that we're okay to accept the dog, and they know that we're prepared. And our goal is, as a team, our goal is to create a template of that protocol that as other places start to allow animals to be, police dogs to be carried in ambulances, that they could then adapt that protocol to their area.
And how does it work now? So this exists in the Champaign-Urbana area. There's this agreement with Carl and with VetMed. Does this exist anywhere else in Illinois? Does this exist, for example, in Chicago?
Right now, New York is the only state that we know of that allows police canines to ride in ambulances. And as far as we have been able to find out, there is no standard template that people are using. And what we'd like to do is get ahead of that so that here, when we can transport them, and then if it spreads to other states, we will have that in place so people can use that and not get into an emergency where you've picked up a canine and don't know where to take it.
So, Dr. McMichael, there's actually currently legislation in Springfield to approve the use of ambulances for working dogs that are injured in the line of duty, something Carl Ambulances are already doing. You said this protocol you're hoping to establish. What difference do you think this law would make for other towns in Illinois then?
I think this law will make it so that people can ideally use this template. And I think as this goes forward, we will all come up with more questions than answers we have. Right now, we're working on two aspects. We're working on the treatment protocol and the transport protocol. And the treatment protocol is making ambulance personnel aware of restraint, appropriate restraint, where to give an injection, where to make sure they have a muzzle, how to give an intravenous injection if they need to, all of that, and CPR and first aid.
So it's not just as simple as, Dr. Smith, what you're talking about, maybe administering Narcan to a canine dog.
Yeah, that's accurate. Our first impetus to get together and talk was this crisis with the opioids. But then as we talked further, we realized, boy, there are a lot of other things that we can do, combining the knowledge and expertise of veterinary medicine to the assets that we already have on the street. Make no mistake, our ambulance crew's primary mission is and always will be the treatment of human beings. And so our protocol specifically states, if there's an issue where you have both a dog and a human injured, we take care of humans first. That's what we do. But we have the capability and the equipment to be able to also render some aid to these police dogs. And so our intention and what we're working and training our staff to do is to deliver that aid in a timely fashion.
And I imagine it's a case of not just these dogs being trained and being considered part of a police force because they do really play a valuable role. I imagine it's also pretty expensive to be training these dogs. And it's a vested interest to make sure that they are also protected.
That's exactly correct. I mean, we don't have to sell this concept to dog lovers. Every dog lover
right.
listening out there knows
but this
I'm sure
is there
something
are people
we
who are
do.
Thinking it's just a dog, too.
Yes, for the cat lovers out there, a police dog costs on average $18,000 to train. And so if you pay taxes, you want us to do what we can to save these animals.
What's next with you guys for this protocol then? And part of it is establishing and getting the word out, Dr. McMichael?
Correct. And we're doing some training in Springfield to about 100 police canine handlers. And we will be giving them a survey. So we're trying to get a little bit of data together, a survey of how comfortable they are right now giving Narcan. And then after we do the training, we'll do another survey to see if that has helped their comfortability.
Dr. Maureen McMichael is a professor in veterinary clinical medicine at the University of Illinois. I want to thank her as well as Drs. Smith and Ware from Carl Emergency Departments, both of them physicians there, and with the Carl Regional Emergency Medical System. Thanks so much. Thank you all for being
with
me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up on Monday's program, we're going to be speaking with British-Nigerian writer Sarah Ladipo Manyika, who says she wants to see more stories about women of a certain age.
I was finding so many interesting, flamboyant older women in real life, but I wasn't seeing them on the page. I always paraphrase Toni Morrison when she says, if there are stories that you want to read but you can't find them, then you must write them.
We'll talk with her about her latest book. She's going to be in Illinois next week to talk about that. Plus, as always, on Monday, we'll bring you the latest in Illinois politics. We'll also discuss pregnancy and maternal health. Why are C-section rates so different from one hospital to the next? We'll be getting answers from the head of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in Illinois and a Peoria-based health reporter. As always, you can find past shows on the NPR One app, Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. You need to have NPR enabled, but ask Alexa, tell NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow, that's 21st show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Search for us on Facebook. The 21st is how you can like us. Search for that. You can comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.